Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a regular Lowy Institute podcast where we sit down with leading experts to discuss foreign policy and international issues. My name is Natasha Kassam and I direct the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Program at the Lowy Institute here in Sydney, Australia. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which the Institute stands, and pay respects to their elders past and present. Today, I'm thrilled to be discussing Taiwan-Australia relations with three experts, Jia Chen, an associate professor at the University of Western Australia, Sophie McIntyre, senior lecturer at the Queensland University of Technology, and Roger Huang, lecturer at Macquarie University. The recent history of Taiwan-Australia relations is complicated, but to very briefly summarize, when the Chinese Communist Party established the People's Republic of China with Beijing as its capital, the nationalist forces under Chiang Kai-shek retreated to Taiwan, relocating the capital of the Republic of China to Taipei. The people living in Taiwan at that point had been living under Japanese rule since 1895. From Australia's side, Canberra continued to recognise Taipei until the establishment of diplomatic relations with the People's Republic in 1972. The joint communique between Australia and the People's Republic of China recognised the government of the People's Republic as China's sole legal government and acknowledged, but did not recognise, the position of the People's Republic that Taiwan was a province of the People's Republic of China. This switch has not prevented unofficial dealings between the Australian government officials and Taiwan government officials. And Taiwan and Australia maintain representative offices in the other's country and have close trade, investment, tourism, and people-to-people ties. We can see warming ties, particularly from the Australian side, where in the 2022 Lowy Institute poll, warmth towards Taiwan has increased substantially up to 64 degrees on our feelings thermometer, whereas warmth towards China is sitting at 33 degrees. It was as recently as 2018 where the two, Taiwan and China, were receiving the same rating. In addition, this year, for the first time, the majority of Australians say that the Australian Defence Force should go to Taiwan in the case that China were to invade and the United States intervened. So I'm thrilled to have this panel here today. And to start, Roger, can you tell us about how you see the current state of the relationship between Taiwan and Australia today?
Well, I think for far too long, Taiwan has been considered almost an afterthought by the Australian government, particularly because of the close economic relationship between China and Australia in the last several years. Now, of course, in the last couple of years, especially under the coalition government under Prime Minister Morrison, there's been a lot of open rhetoric that seems to be broadly supportive of a fellow democracy, that is Taiwan. But I feel like a lot of that rhetoric is based on, again, that consideration of the potential threat of China and also for domestic political considerations. Of course, infamously, Prime Minister Morrison has repeatedly and publicly said that he supported a one country, two system for Taiwan, which is contrary to Australia's actual position. So it demonstrates that at the political elite level, there's still a lot of misunderstandings amongst themselves exactly how Taiwan factors in Australia's consideration. Now, of course, we now have a new ALP government under Anthony Albanese. So I think it is a great time for Australia to carefully reconsider how to honestly have a serious discussion of where Australia wants to go with its relationship with Taiwan, as well as how this have implications on how it also wants to address its relationship with China.
That's really interesting. And the issue you point to of Taiwan being used for domestic political purposes, that's actually something that came up during the election campaign in Australia with now Foreign Minister Penny Wong really criticizing, I think, the then government for using Taiwan for these purposes. So we're still kind of waiting to see exactly what the new government will do. But Jia, I wanted to ask you, there's been much more emphasis on democracy in Australian foreign policy in the past few years. We had the Morrison government talk about an arc of autocracy. Prime Minister Albanese, just in the last few days, you know, as he's at the NATO meetings, is saying that democracies need to push back. Is this something that you see as playing a role in the Australia-Taiwan relationship?
Well, electioneering aside, and it's all over, I think this emphasis on democracy and democracy's role as bedrock of Indo-Pacific diplomacy. That is kind of common. It's not just with Australia and America, but all the other allies and partners in the region. I think that is a good omen in a very fundamental sense, good omen for Australia-Taiwan relations. Well, for two simple reasons. First of all, emphasis on democracy really illuminates what both Taiwan and Australia stand for. In other words, at the end of the day, you know, one country, two systems aside, one China principle aside, there is this inherent solidarity of values. And that is very important for the future of the bilateral relationship. Secondly, as fellow democracies, I mean, this is common emphasis on the values, would actually push the two democracies closer because both are in the same boat in terms of being threatened by autocracy from Beijing. And that, anyway, I would hope that would also enable Australia to see the democratic presence or whatever is still remaining of it, of Taiwan in South Pacific and in Southeast Asia. And that provides room for exploring, you know, collaboration in those regions.
I think it's really interesting the extent to which Australia and Taiwan both do see themselves threatened as autocracies. Of course, in the case of Taiwan, it's quite explicit. You know, I was at the Shangri-La Dialogue a couple of weeks ago and heard the Chinese defense minister, you know, very clearly state the threat that China poses to Taiwan. In the case of Australia, I think it is much more a perception issue. Again, in the recent Lowy Institute poll, 75% of Australians think that China will pose a military threat to Australia. That's actually higher than the number in Taiwan that worry about China's threat. So it's interesting how, despite the difference in proximity, the difference in rhetoric, there is that heightened threat perception here in Australia. Sophie, I want to turn to you because we so often hear about Taiwan and its place in the world purely from this security perspective, and I'm certainly guilty of that myself. But you look at these non-traditional perspectives, and I'd really love to hear more about your research in Australia-Taiwan relations from that different angle and what you've been finding.
Sure. Yes, there does tend to be an emphasis on politics, economics, trade, and when we talk about Taiwan. But I think culture plays an incredibly important role in terms of international diplomacy in particular. I think culture really stands in for the nation, if we can call it that, given that Taiwan doesn't have a seat in the UN and it's excluded from a lot of international fora. So my research really looks at modern and contemporary art in Taiwan, and particularly since the lifting of martial law in 1987. So looking really at how democratisation has really impacted on the visual arts field. I'm particularly interested, or my book was explored the ways in which artists during the 1990s and 2000s responded to national identity issues and how that was reflected in their artwork as well as in domestic and international exhibitions. So cultural diplomacy is part of that research, and looking at the ways in which the government has supported particular artistic practices that really promote Taiwan as a democratic, culturally pluralistic society.
And is that something that has been received well in other nations? And I ask particularly because I'm very interested in the way that our new Labor government has been promoting more of this kind of cultural sense of Australia in their outreach. Foreign Minister Penny Wong's speech in Malaysia, talking about her upbringing, the idea that we're going to have First Nations ambassador. I can see these issues becoming more prominent in Australian foreign policy. So how has Taiwan's cultural diplomacy in that way, how's it been received?
I think there are various types of cultural diplomacy. I think there's a kind of capital D diplomacy, which does tend to get conflated, I think, with public diplomacy. There is an argument that some scholars make that sometimes culture is used as a tool to promote national foreign policy and the identity of the nation, sometimes to the detriment, some might argue, to the artist's own practice and intentions. But there are also other types of diplomacy that operate on a sort of smaller scale, I suppose, including artist residencies, workshops, symposia. We just, I was involved in organising an international symposium focusing on Indigenous artists in Taiwan, Australia and New Zealand, and in collaboration with partners in both places. And so I think that was really an opportunity for Indigenous artists to really have a dialogue, because that's quite often that opportunity is often missed in these larger capital D diplomacy cultural efforts, such as large-scale exhibitions, which are more operate on a more official level. So I think to answer your question in a rather long-winded way, I think the reception to Taiwan culture, at least in my experience as a curator organising exhibitions, Australians tend to be quite positively surprised at the diversity. I think a lot of people here, or at least in the 1990s when I curated the first exhibition of Taiwan art that toured Australia, that people were actually saying, oh, I actually thought that, you know, it was all about traditional Chinese calligraphy and Chinese literati painting, whereas in fact these artists were actually doing some really quite sophisticated and somewhat subversive, creating quite subversive works, focusing on martial law and the effects of martial law and censorship on culture and people's sense of identity. So I think Taiwan's also quite keen to promote those democratic aspects as well, and it's kind of pluralistic identity, including in particular its Indigenous Austronesian identity, and that's been happening in the last decade or so.
I think that is really fascinating, and the Indigenous experiences of Australia and Taiwan, whether it be through art, whether it be through efforts to reconciliation, you know, President Tsai's apology to Indigenous people, I am reliably told, was somewhat inspired by Australia's own apology. And so that there is a lot of space there. And I think, as you say, and to go back to Roger's point about a low level of awareness in Australia, there's a lot that can be done to build that. Earlier this year, I was at the Asia Pacific Triennial up in Queensland, and there was the most incredible room of Taiwanese Indigenous art. And everybody who walked in there was really very surprised by it. And, you know, I definitely had conversations with many people there who didn't know that Taiwan had Indigenous people, for example. So there's definitely a role to play there, I think, and it's really interesting to hear about the long-standing relationship you've had there as well.
Well, I'm just pleased to know that the majority of Australians now don't call Taiwan Thailand, because that was definitely the response that I got when I said I was going to Taiwan. Oh, you'll have fun on the beaches then.
I mean, there are definitely still some people who are thinking that, but again, one of the things that came out really interestingly from our annual Lowy Institute poll was that 68% of Australians agree that Taiwan is a democracy. That's up 16 points in just 2 years. So that recognition of Taiwan as a democracy and as something completely separate, I don't know about Thailand, but to China, where only 7% of Australians said that China was a democracy. So I think that awareness is growing in many ways, and maybe back to Roger's earlier point, sometimes for the wrong reasons, but it is growing. Roger, this is really fascinating to hear about those kind of non-traditional perspectives, but you've also been working on Taiwan's diaspora in Australia and the way in which that might influence the bilateral relationship. Can you tell us about the Taiwanese diaspora here and then the role that maybe you see them playing in the bilateral relationship?
Well, the interesting thing is the Taiwanese government has always relied on the diaspora for a lot of things, even before all these changes and democratization and whatnot. Of course, during the Cold War period, you have kind of the Free China anti-communist lobby that existed, whether in Australia or the US and elsewhere. But moving forward to kind of, you know, contemporary times, because of Taiwan's ambiguous international standing, the Taiwanese government had to rely on a lot of these unofficial channels through the local Taiwanese Australian, Taiwanese American, et cetera, communities overseas. Now, there are some problems with this because, of course, like any other communities, there's different factions, different politics. And I think there's a lot of messy messaging, right? So one clear thing the Taiwanese government has been doing, and this has been alluded by Sophie and others, is to promote this brand of Taiwanese democracy, you know, freedom, and all that. And in that manner, I think has been relatively successful, as you've just pointed out also in the Lowy opinion polls. But on the other hand, if you remember just a few years ago, the Taiwanese government, and with a lot of support from the local community here, the Taiwanese Australian community in New South Wales, brought these treasures from National Palace Museum of Taiwan. Now, of course, these treasures are all traditional ancient Chinese treasures, which for the large part, I think a large majority of more, at least certainly the younger generation, does not see this as really Taiwanese culture anymore. So when you have this big effort of the Taiwanese community here, having some sort of disconnect perhaps to what the younger generation is considering in Taiwan as being representative of Taiwanese culture, then this creates this mixed messaging. Going back to that issue, where if on the one hand you're trying to promote Taiwan identity as being separate from China or Chinese heritage, bringing these old treasures perhaps is a very confusing message, especially for the larger public who has no understanding of the complexities of China and Taiwan's history and relationship.
It's really interesting to me that often when I meet members of the Taiwanese diaspora, they do seem to have, in some cases, their politics frozen in time from when they migrated. And so particularly when people migrated perhaps before Taiwan transitioned to democracy, they have quite a different conception of Taiwanese culture and history. And I think at that time there was much less recognition of Taiwan's own indigenous history. And so the idea of that now being promoted as a part of Taiwanese identity, it doesn't always gel with some of those earlier migrants. Now, we've already talked a little bit about Indigenous art, but Sophie, are there also connections between Australian Indigenous communities and Taiwanese Indigenous communities? Is that something that could be another way to foster bilateral ties?
Yeah, definitely. That's, as I mentioned, it's really, particularly since Tsai Ing-wen came to power as president in 2016, there's been a lot more investment in promoting Indigenous art under particularly this Austronesian banner since that time. And so we're seeing a lot of Indigenous artists, and particularly artists who may have a Han Chinese sort of background, brought up in that Han Chinese education, going back to their villages, rediscovering their Indigenous identity, and spending time in their village and learning the kind of crafts and the languages and the culture of their community, of their Indigenous community. But certainly in exhibitions, as you mentioned, the Asia Pacific Triennial, that's been the largest representation of Taiwan art in the Asia Pacific Triennial so far, representing 8 Indigenous artists. And as you said, it was a, you know, fantastic showcase, I think, of Indigenous art and the diversity of Indigenous art in Taiwan. There are also really interesting developments, I think, between Australia and Taiwan in this context of Indigenous art through programs such as Art NT, based up in the Northern Territory, and the Indigenous Council for Indigenous Peoples, I think, in Taiwan, where they have a residency program and an Indigenous artist from Australia goes to Taiwan for 6 weeks, and similarly an Indigenous artist from Taiwan goes to Australia. So I think it's I think those kind of exchanges, when we're talking about cultural diplomacy, are really valuable, because even though it might be one person's experience, it actually, when we think about social media and the connections that people have now globally, that message gets out, and that knowledge and the skills that they've gained through that residency are more widely understood and appreciated. And so I think that's a really valuable program, and I'm hoping that there'll be more of those kind of programs where it might be sort of small D diplomacy rather than the capital D showcase diplomacy.
So that's really interesting, and I'd never heard of that program. Is it deliberately under the radar to be, as you say, small D diplomacy, or are people, or is there just lots of these little things going on that aren't necessarily getting that much attention?
There are a lot of things that are happening that sort of fall under the radar a bit, that are often curator or artist initiated, but they're not presented in a state galleries or national galleries. So a lot of artist-initiated programs, but also AsiaLink has been doing an amazing job too of promoting, not specifically within the Indigenous art area, but that is, they certainly have had some Indigenous artists, I believe, doing residencies both in Taiwan and Australia.
Gia, I wanted to ask you, you know, Taiwan is considered one of the most progressive countries in Asia. You know, it's rated by Freedom House as amongst the most free. But of course, like every country, it has its own human rights issues, whether that's the treatment of migrant workers or refugee policy. You know, of course, Australia takes advantage of the fact that Taiwan is not a member of the Refugee Convention and sends out refugees there for medical treatment, for example. So is that an issue when it comes to Taiwan's efforts to promote democracy?
Well, that is certainly a huge dent of Taiwan's democracy, capital D diplomacy. Yeah, well, certainly I'm aware of the high rating Taiwan has always received from agencies such as Freedom House. Its new report for this year has just been released. Like Taiwan, probably just like last year, getting 95 out of 100. So classified as fully free, right? And there's no doubt about that. On the other hand, and I have been following Taiwan's democracy diplomacy, and I'm also, you know, I've been studying on Taiwan's social movements, campaigning for democracy and for migrant workers' rights and all that. And the sort of NGOs which are not convenient to MOFA's NGO diplomacy. There has been a long-standing issue of violation of human rights of Southeast Asian workers, construction workers, and maids, and Indonesian fishermen. It has been going, you know, headline news in the region, transnational advocacy networks for many, many years. Even Freedom House has mentioned that consistently. And also, I'm particularly aware that Taiwan has got no coherent or transparent policy towards asylum seekers from China, as if accepting asylum seekers from China, even those well-known democracy activists, as if accepting them would pull Taiwan back to one China framework. That fee is totally unwarranted. And I know a couple of cases where Chinese asylum seekers, Democrats, fleeing to Thailand first, then going to Taipei and stranded in the Taoyuan International Airport for more than 100 days and being allowed to walk out only when after Canadian government agreed to accept them. Okay? And similar cases going on. And I'm really astonished that asylum seekers from Hong Kong over the past 3 years has been treated a similar way. And you're talking about asylum seekers, Hong Kong youths, who were dodging national security law, risking their lives in the sea and arriving in Kaohsiung, being detained, no access to lawyers or NGOs, then went to America under mysterious circumstances. So I would say, and I don't see any chance for asylum cases from Thailand, from Myanmar activists. And I think these issues really have to be sorted out in order for Taiwan to fully claim that it is integrated into international human rights mechanism, a model international citizen. And, you know, Otherwise, I see that is actually tarnishing the standing with somewhat of this democracy diplomacy.
Well, unfortunately, I think that a very poor approach to refugee treatment is something Australia and Taiwan have in common. And in both cases, we've seen many would-be refugees end up in the United States, actually, you know, for all of its flaws. It does maintain a more welcoming approach on some of these issues. So, Raja, I want to ask you about the role of the United States and how that plays in the Taiwan-Australia relationship. You know, there's been back and forth over decades about the obligations that the United States has or does not have in terms of Taiwan. Of course, we've heard President Biden say a few times now that he believes they have an obligation to defend Taiwan. How much do you think that the US positioning on Taiwan is a factor for thinking here in Canberra? And, you know, is Australia under pressure to do more?
Well, I think the U.S. has made it increasingly clear with all these supposedly Freudian slips from President Biden, right, that the U.S. takes the security situation in Taiwan Strait very, very seriously. And this inevitably has also pressured Canberra to take note of these recent shifts and changes. Now, I think there's some things we also need to consider is that there's often this kind of simplification of Australia simply as a deputy sheriff to the US. It actually takes away a lot of agency Canberra does have and also what Canberra has done in the past. If you just need to recall, Australia recognized the People's Republic of China before the United States did, right? Australia was the first country that banned Huawei from its 5G networks. So Australia has not just simply followed U.S. kind of orders, really. It has taken its own initiative. Having said that, because the U.S.'s position, you know, is security guarantee in the region, obviously Canberra does need to look carefully of any significant changes in the U.S. and need to really consider what is in Australia's interest. Now, this means a lot of things that the U.S. has been pressuring Australia to do, including the freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. How do Australia address that? Australia is looking at trying to repair its relations with China, but at the same time, we've also seen Australia being continually sucked into the broader U.S.-led kind of hegemonic order, if you will. Anthony Albanese, of course, right now is in Europe at the NATO, and NATO has already pointed out that China, even despite the invasion of Ukraine and Russia, China has been singled out as another potential real threat to global order, right? So, yes, Canberra's under a lot of pressure from the U.S. to kind of keep this unity intact, and I think that is important if people really believe in preserving some sort of a democratic order. But at the same time, Canberra does have its own agency, as it's demonstrated in the past.
And Gia, that's the kind of US factor in the relationship. What about the Australia-China relationship? How much is that a factor for Australia's thinking and its dealings with Taiwan?
Well, it is almost like cliche, but also common sense to say that the China factor has long been the elephant in the room. Whenever you talk about Taiwan's relations with any country, any third party. But I would argue that does not mean that Australia cannot should not be more proactive and less ad hoc. I think the problem with Australia, so far as I can observe, and you can write big book about this, in a nutshell, Australia has had more of a self-censorship compared to, let's say, some countries in Southeast Asia. Interestingly, you would assume that these countries are scared of China more than Australia does. Actually, when it comes to Taiwan, it's not always like that. So Australia has had more of a censorship than many countries in the Indo-Pacific region in terms of, upgrading the diplomatic representation, ministerial-level dialogues, and, being proactively opening up sort of, initiatives in collaborating with Taiwan. So what I like to argue is that even under the shadow of China, we can be more proactive in responding to Taiwan's persistent approaches to Australia. For instance, Taiwan has included Australia as part of, you know, present Tsai's south-going strategy. You know, is there any discussion on that approach of Taiwan, how Australia is reacting to that? And is it possible to have some sort of streamlining under current circumstances of the way to deal with Taiwan from federal level down to, let's say, the state and the council, you know, coming from WA, and see the state government is kind of hostile to Taiwan, to Taiwan representation, and same way to Tibetan exiles, by the way. You know, then there are other states probably deal with Taiwan differently. So, and also Australia needs to have a dialogue with Taiwan to see, to open more room for collaboration in various ways. For instance, in Southeast Asia, where Taiwan has extensive network of alumni, Taiwan, Taiwan investors, and in South Pacific, where Taiwan still has a presence. And also, although it is important for Taiwan, for us to see a culturally diverse new Taiwan, on the other hand, we should not lose sight of Taiwan's value as representing a free Chinese culture. And a lot of people in the Chinese diaspora in Australia look to Taiwan for inspiration to see the future transition of China. And it would be really counterproductive to lose sight of that sort of significance of Taiwan. See, those sort of areas, what, you know, Taiwan and Australia can do together.
Well, Gia, I think you've already answered my last question, which I'll put to Roger and Sophie. What do you want to see change under the new Australian government? Is there a point of optimism or something that you're hoping for? Quick lightning round before we finish
up. Yes, very quickly. I think Gia covered a lot of these things, that I think the Australian government has been a lot more conservative than it needs to be. Obviously, a few years ago, there were discussions about free trade agreements between Taiwan and Australia, and Australia quickly backed down when the then foreign minister of China, Wang Yi, kind of threatened to basically retaliation. And given the last couple of years, relationship between Australia and China has already been so poor, I don't really know how much more China can punish Australia. So Australia must well take a bolder stand in doing things that it thinks is right. And I don't think anything like free trade agreement or the recent discussions of the comprehensive trade agreements, all these things Australia can certainly support and would, I think, bring greater prosperity and peace in the region.
And Sophie, the final word.
Well, I come from an academic, from a university, so I would say education. And I think the Australian government does have their new Colombo plan, and I run actually a study tour to Taiwan, which is funded through the new Colombo plan, and taking young people from Australia to Taiwan, their perceptions are completely challenged. I think I saw their eyes open wide to a very different image of Taiwan that I think they thought of Taiwan in very sort of conservative, traditional terms, and they're really surprised at how culturally vibrant it is. So I would say thinking about the next generation, education, study tours, more culture, please, and funding needs to come with that. So that's what I would be advocating for.
Sophie, Roger, Gia, thank you so much for your time. I've learnt a lot from all of you. You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations. I'd like to thank my colleague Josh Goding for his production assistance, the Taiwanese Foundation for Democracy for their support in bringing Gia and Sophie to Sydney, and Mei Feng Kuo from Macquarie University for her assistance in facilitating this conversation. You can find many other Lowy Institute conversations and events on our website and wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.